Abu Ja'far Muhammad ibn Hassan al-Tusi, known as Sheikh al-Ta'ifa, scholar of the sect, was a prominent scholar of the Shia Islamic belief. He was born in the holy month of Ramadan in the year 385 after Hijra in the city of Tus in Iran. Sheikh al-Tusi grew up in Tus and began his studies there. He has been held in very high esteem among the Shia scholars. His greatness can be seen from the very fact that he was the author of two of the four most important books of the Shia faith, and more importantly, as the person who established the Islamic seminary Hawza in the holy city of Najaf. This documentary looks at the life of this great scholar and his great work.
الكلام حول عنصر من عناصر التشيع الذي يثني له التاريخ وتثني له العلوم وتثني له الدنيا بمواقفها وبمواقفه لما أفاض على هذا الكون وعلى هذه الحياة من علوم لا زالت منذ عقود من الزمان ألا وهو أبو الحسن محمد الطوسي الطوسي هو أبو جعفر محمد بن الحسن علي بن الحسن الطوسي ولد في مدينة طوس مدينة طوس كما هو معروف هي ناحية من نواحي خراسان كانت في ذلك الزمان الآن تسمى بمدينة مشهد مشهد الإمام الرضا صلى الله وسلامه عليه وهذه المدينة أيضا يشهد لها التاريخ لما أنجبت فيها من العلماء ومن الفطاحل ومن المواقف التي تشرف بها مذهب أهل البيت لما عانت فيه هذه المنطقة كما هو ديدا المناطق التي تحتوي مراقد أهل البيت على الأرض من أعداء أهل البيت دائما أنه يحاربون أهل البيت في حياتهم وحتى بعد حياتهم وهم في قبورهم فالمناطق التي تشهد فيها مشاهد قبور أهل البيت صلى الله وسلامه عليه التاريخ يذكر لنا مرورا بكل منطقة منها أنه قد عانت ما عانت من أعداء مذهب أهل البيت ومن أعداء أهل البيت لأجل أنه طمس اسمهم ولكن الله سبحانه وتعالى يأبى إلا أن يتم نوره ولو كره المشركون فأبو جعفر محمد الطوسي ولد قلنا في مدينة طوس في القرن الرابع الهجري نهاية القرن الرابع الهجري في سنة 385 في مدينة طوس ترعرع في ذلك المكان وبدأ يأخذ علومه ويأخذ المعالم الأخرى لحياته في ذلك الموطن لغاية عام 400 أو في القرن الرابع الخامس الهجري يعني من عمر 385 إلى عمر كأنه 23 سنة من عمره في القرن الخامس الهجري انتقل إلى بغداد يعني كأنه حياة الطوسي تنقسم بصورة رئيسية إلى مرحلتين أساسية بعد انتقاله من مدينة طوس إلى بغداد كأنه عاش في بغداد في حياته أثمرت عن عطاء كبير له اللي استغرق أنه في حياته في بغداد 12 سنة وفي لما أنه تصدى المرجعي وصار أنه الزعيم الأكبر لطائفة أهل البيت ثم انتقل بعد ذلك إلى النجف أيضا بقى في النجف 12 سنة يعني من أنه كأنه من سنة 413 هجرية، يعني في بداية القرن الخامس إلى عمر 460 كانت في وفاته، قضاها كلها في العراق ما بين بغداد والنجف.
He moved to Baghdad when he was 23, which was around 405. He moved to Baghdad. That time, Baghdad was the center of the education, and many scholars were there in Baghdad, specifically Sheikh Mufid. Then his student Sayyid al-Murtada Alim al-Huda, both brothers, Sharif al-Radi, the compiler of Nahj al-Balagha, and his eldest brother Sharif al-Murtada. He studied there in Baghdad and became one of the outstanding figures within the Shia community there.
There are a number of reasons why Sheikh Tusi is significant. He was in a particular period where you find, I guess, the crystallization of Shia literature happening. Everything from the compilation of hadith to the establishment of fiqh, to usul al-fiqh, the legal theory, the development of the exegesis of the Quran, and also the development of theology. And the significance of him is that he's one of the first figures who arguably makes a contribution in all of these fields. And it's because of that wide-ranging set of contributions that he makes that he was then considered to be a pivotal figure. And he does this partly because of certain legacies that he has in terms of who he studied with, the sort of learning which he inherited. So part of it's about what he inherited from Sayyid al-Murtada, who of course was probably his most significant teacher. And it's also the inheritance of texts which had already developed, particularly the earlier compilations of hadith and the contributions of Sheikh al-Saduq, a generation before him. So he kind of brings everything together and really establishes a corpus which then, for the next two centuries, defines what the Shia tradition is.
بقى الشيخ الطوسي مع الشيخ المفيد لمدة خمس سنين من 408 إلى 413 تحت رعايته تحت درسه. سنلاحظ في هذه المسألة أنه لما قدم الشيخ الطوسي إلى بغداد والتحق بدرس الشيخ المفيد، والشيخ المفيد هو بدوره كان أعلى مرتبة ومنزلة علمية في ذلك الوقت، يشير أو يدل على أنه مدى العلم الذي كان حامله الشيخ الطوسي في مرتعه في لما ترعرع في طوس وهو من العمر 23 سنة. حتما لما أنه يدخل إلى مناطق أخرى أو يدخل الدروس كن أن يكون مؤهل أن يتقبل هذا الدرس الذي يدخله أو يستوعبه. فبهذا العمر مباشرة لما جاء إلى بغداد صار تلميذا عند الشيخ المفيد، ولكن الشيخ المفيد رأى فيه الشيء الذي يستحق العناية، فدخل الشيخ الطوسي إلى درس الشيخ المفيد وهو في هذا العمر 23 سنة لما جاء من طوس، يدل دلالة على أنه كان حاملا من العلوم وحاملا من الثقافة ومن الوعي، قادر على أن يستوعب الدرس الأكبر في ذلك الوقت من العلوم. فاحتضنه الشيخ المفيد لما رأى هذه القابليات موجودة عند مثل هذا الشخص، أخذ يحتضنه ويعتني به اعتناء خاص. ولكن الشيخ المفيد لم يطيل بقاء مع الشيخ الطوسي لأنه وافاه الأجل 413 هجري على مدة خمس سنين فقط أنه مجيء الشيخ الطوسي إلى بغداد، عاشر الشيخ المفيد خمس سنين لأنه وافاه الأجل في هذه الفترة. بعد ذلك انتقلت الزعامة زعامة مذهب أهل البيت إلى الشريف المرتضى.
At the age of 23 in the year 408 after Hijra, Sheikh Tusi moved to Baghdad and remained in Iraq up until his death. Since Baghdad was the capital of the Abbasids ever since the times of Mansur al-Dawaniqi, since the time of the sixth Imam, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, peace be upon him, till the period when Sheikh Tusi flourished there, Baghdad was the center of Islamic studies. Eminent scholars were the residents of the city. Thus, the Shia population continued to increase progressively in the capital city. When Sheikh Tusi migrated to Baghdad, the name of Sheikh al-Mufid was very famous and the talk of the town. People used to join his school on knowing that he was the chief of the institution. Both Sunni and Shia seekers of knowledge would attend classes with him. Therefore, Sheikh Tusi also joined lessons at the school of Sheikh al-Mufid at the age of 23. Sheikh Tusi started taking lessons with Sheikh al-Mufid and later on with Sayyid al-Murtada.
لما انتقل إلى بغداد في عمر 23 سنة من عمره أنه كانت الزعامة الدينية بغداد كانت منطقة علمية تتوافد فيها العلماء من جميع المذاهب علماء المسلمين بصورة عامة لا تختص بدين أو بمذهب خاص دين الإسلامي لكن لا تختص بمذهب خاص إنما كان الوضع في بغداد منفتح على جميع المذاهب ولذلك كان علماء من جميع المذاهب يتواجدون إلى بغداد فاختيار الطوسي أنه الذهاب إلى بغداد كان موفقا كثيرا لينال من العلوم ما نال به بالتوفيق في الدنيا وفي الأخرى فدخل إلى بغداد عام 413 بداية القرن الخامس الهجري كانت الزعامة في ذلك الوقت إلى الشيخ المفيد قدس الله نفسه الزكية الشيخ المفيد كما هو معروف من العلماء الكبار الذي شهد له التاريخ مواقفه وعلمه وما أعطاه من خير إلى الدنيا بصورة عامة فالشيخ المفيد كما تذكر أنه الروايات أنه عند وفاته الإمام الحجة صلى الله وسلامه عليه أرثاه في قصيدة منها أنه في بداية لا صوت الناعي بفقدك إنه يوم على آل الرسول عظيم هذه يعني رثاء من الإمام الحجة صلى الله وسلامه عليه إلى الشيخ المفيد بمعنى هذه المنزلة العظيمة التي كان ينالها هذا الشخص في تلك الفترة الشيخ المفيد كان أيضا من الفطاحل للعلماء بحيث أنه كان كرسي الكلام يعني بوجود مختلف المذاهب في ذلك الوقت كان كرسي الكلام يسمى وهذا الكرسي لا يجلس عليه إلا من طوت العلوم له أو طوى الوسادة للعلوم له.
Of course, we know that in that period it was very common for people to travel in search of knowledge, in search of the right sort of teachers, in search of sources. So he's born in Tus. He moves to Baghdad, which at that time is certainly the major center. In fact, arguably, it's during his lifetime that the centrality of Baghdad for the Shia community, particularly for the scholarly community, comes to an end, and there's reasons for that, which I'll come to in a second. So he moves to Baghdad, he studies with Sayyid Murtada and various other figures in that period, and this is a period which is sometimes called a period of the Shia ascendancy, quite simply because the effective rulers of Baghdad are basically Shia commanders, the Buyids as they're called, who were deputizing for the Abbasid caliphs. So it's a time in which there's a lot of freedom for people to teach, for people to discuss their ideas, for the community to develop, for the community to write texts which tell people what they are and who they are, and of course tell their own people who they are. It's during his lifetime, of course, that shifts. So later on in his life, the Buyids are displaced by the Seljuk Turks from the east. The Seljuks come with a very clear mandate in many ways to replace the Shia ascendancy and to establish, I guess, what you might nowadays call a more straightforward Sunni ascendancy. And they do that in a number of different ways. They establish later on madrasas in Baghdad and elsewhere, which propagate their particular theology, their particular legal schools. So for example, particularly they support the Shafi'i and the Hanafi Sunni legal schools. They support what then becomes known as Ash'ari theology, which becomes dominant in the Sunni world. And to a certain extent, they support the what sometimes is called the mob in Baghdad, who are broadly speaking traditionalist Sunnis. Because of the shift in power, what happens is a number of the old Shia elite who are in Kirkh and other places are gradually displaced, houses are attacked, libraries are burnt down. It becomes increasingly unsafe to be there. And because of that unsafe environment, he decides to move to Najaf, which, as we all know, is a certain distance from Baghdad. At that time, certainly would have been a very small place. Was not a place known as a center for scholarship. But what's important is there's a recognition, I think already by that time, that scholarship does and should continue alongside a place of pilgrimage and a shrine. So you get, in many ways, with his moving to Najaf, the establishment of this link between the shrine, a sacred space associated with the Imam or a significant person of the Ahlul Bayt, and the notion that that sanctity which invites pilgrimage, which invites visitation, should also be a center of learning.
When we know that Imam Ali alayhi salam, being the gate to the city of knowledge of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, this is an authentic hadith narrated by all. All Muslims narrate that. أَنَا مَدِينَةُ الْعِلْمُ وَعَلِيٌّ بَابُهَا. So he, Imam Ali alayhi salam, was buried in Najaf, which is approximately 150-60 kilometers south Baghdad, not that far, or 100 miles. Yeah. So the shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam there, and the spirit of Imam Ali alayhi salam, this was something to encourage Sheikh Tusi to migrate to Najaf. Later on, some other centers became famous, like Karbala, like Hilla, like Tripoli in Lebanon, but remained Najaf all the time as the center of the spiritual guidance and getting that blessing from the soul Imam Ali alayhi salam.
After the death of his mentor, Sayyid Murtada Alam al-Huda, Sheikh al-Tusi succeeded him as the chairman of the theological center in Baghdad. Sheikh al-Tusi remained in Baghdad for a period of 12 years after the demise of his teacher. A series of invasions soon afterwards caused destruction to his house and his shifting to Najaf, where he established the Najaf Theological Center.
We know that according to the Sunni school of thought, there were six compilations of hadiths known as As-Sihah al-Sitta, or the six books, that all scholars, whether they are Hanafis, Shafi'is, Hanbalis, Malikis, when they have any reference after the Quran or even any elaboration of the Quran, they refer to a hadith of these six books. When we look at the Shia sources, we see that as early as the time of Kulayni, Saduq, and Sheikh Tusi, they had again collections of hadith known as Al-Kutub Al-Arba'ah, the four collections. Two of these were written and compiled by Sheikh Tusi. So the first one was by Kulayni. The name of the book is Al-Kafi. Al-Kulayni died year 329 AH. Then it was Man la yahdhuruhu al-faqih for Sheikh Saduq, who died year 381 AH. Then two books written by Sheikh Tusi, one At-Tahdhib, the other one is Al-Istibsar. And both of them, so all the three authors were, the first name was Muhammad. So they are called Al-Muhammadun al-Thalatha, the three Muhammads who wrote Al-Kutub al-Arba'ah. So three Muhammads who wrote four books. So two of out of these were written by Sheikh Tusi first. Second, that Sheikh Tusi has written nearly in every branch of knowledge in Islam, or especially in Shiite. So in the tafsir, or the exegesis for Quran, he wrote At-Tibyan fi Ulum al-Quran. It has been published many times in 10 volumes. So this was purely on tafsir. He wrote on hadith two books, At-Tahdhib and Al-Istibsar. In jurisprudence or fiqh, he wrote many books. One of them more detailed, like Al-Mabsut. The other one, Al-Khilaf. The difference between Al-Mabsut and Al-Khilaf is Al-Mabsut is purely based on the ijtihad of the Shia on jurisprudence, whilst the Khilaf is comparing the opinion of the Shias with the Sunnis. So it is comparative work on fiqh. Other than that, he wrote a concise book of fatwa called An-Nihaya. النهاية في مجرد الفقه والفتاوى. This is like what normally nowadays we refer to رسالة عملية, yeah, as his fatwas there. Fortunately, this النهاية, although is 400 or 500 pages, has been translated into English, very nice English, by Dr. Izzetti and published by ICAS Press. You can see that a book written some 1,000 years ago, 10 centuries ago, when you read it, you see it still as if it's written just now. So detailed about all acts of worship, all commercial law, family law, criminal law, everything based on the fiqh of the Shia. The whole book is well received. Many editions, one by the great historian Sheikh Abu Buzurg, introduction, very good introduction to that An-Nihaya. So in tafsir we have At-Tibyan of Sheikh Tusi. In fiqh or jurisprudence we have Mabsut, Khilaf, and An-Nihaya. Of course, some others, Al-Muqni'ah and some others. Then we have in Imamah, he wrote Talkhis al-Shafi. At the time of Sayyid al-Murtada, there was literature discussion between, or correspondence between, one Mu'tazilite Sunni scholar called Abd al-Jabbar al-Mu'tazili. He wrote Al-Mughni. Then he wrote Al-Shafi. Al-Mughni. Then Sayyid al-Murtada wrote Al-Shafi to refute and to discuss what is in Al-Mughni fil Imama of Abd al-Jabbar al-Mu'tazili. Because Al-Shafi was a detailed one, Sheikh Tusi summarized that under the title of Talkhis al-Shafi, which is again one of the good references about Imama, the succession to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, with all proofs and all supports. In ilm al-rijal, which is very, very important when you talk about the authentication and the character reference of the narrators of the hadith, because if they are not reliable, as unfortunately even in many sources, both in the Shia and Sunnis, yeah, sometimes the hadith is weak. Yeah, so you have to know what is the weak, what is the authentic, what is more likely to be accepted or supported by some other sources. So Ilm al-Rijal, he wrote in al-Rijal, maybe amongst the very first sources and references in Ilm al-Rijal. In Ilm al-Usul, he wrote al-Dhari'a. So we can say that he dealt with every field of knowledge within Islamic studies, and they are available and referred to by all researchers in Shi'i studies.
كتاب الأماني للشيخ الطوسي كان أنه الشيخ الطوسي قادر على أن يستوعب خطبة كاملة تتكون من صفحات متعددة، أربع خمس صفحات أو رسائل أيضا طولها ثلاث أربع صفحات أو روايات كذلك ينقلها كلها عن ظهر قلب، عند إمكانية حفظ وسرعة بديهة وإعطاء ما يستطيع أن يوصل إلى الإنسان، يعني قابلية إيصال الشيء إلى الآخرين. هذا يحتاج لأيضا فد موهبة قابلية. من مؤهلات الشيخ طوسي وهكذا أنه كان يملك إمكانية أنه يقنع الآخر أو يتكلم بما يراه مناسبا لذلك المقابل. هذا من أسباب الانفتاح التي كان يعيشها في بغداد في تلك الفترة. ذكرنا أنه في بغداد كانت منفتحة لجميع العلوم، غير مقتصرة على علم واحد، وإنما يأتي إليها كل العلماء، كل العلماء من جميع المذاهب، لا تقتصر على مذهب واحد. فصار انفتاح للحوارات وللمناظرات وللمشادات بعض الأحيان الكلامية. أثر هذا في الشيخ الطوسي شيء، بل الشيخ الطوسي أثر في هذا لإمكانياته ومؤهلاته الذاتية، يعني استطاع أن يتغلب على كل من هذه الأمور التي يتعرض لها في ذلك الزمن.
There of course are earlier works in fiqh which put together the various rulings on different aspects of ritual law and so forth. One thinks, for example, of the Muqni'ah, particularly of Sheikh Mufid. And in many ways, one thing you can see is that with Sheikh Mufid, who is roughly a generation or so before him, you have an earlier form of something that Sheikh Tulsi does before, after him, in the sense that he tries to make those different types of contributions. It's just that he does them in a much more abbreviated manner. So most of Sheikh Mufid's works are fairly short in comparison. What Sheikh Tulsi does is that he has a much wider and significant contribution. So everything from, you know, the compilation of the two significant rather fiqhi based hadith collections to the establishment of something, texts which increasingly we people nowadays in the seminary would recognize. So both the notion of a work which is a bit like a modern Risala Amaliya, you know, sort of legal rules and various things, as well as the notion of a work in fiqh which also provides proofs for it, right? So what's known as fiqh istidlali, for example. So you have both of those types of contributions in his works. And the simple kind of Risala type work is the Nihaya, of course. Anyone who picks up the Nihaya now recognizes it immediately. It's structurally very similar to a lot of modern texts. And in many ways, it's probably the first serious example of it.
In the year 448 after Hijrah, the residence of Sheikh al-Tusi was also attacked with the intention of killing him. He was not found at home. His residence, his contents, including his books, and his chair, the pulpit, were all burnt, after this most regrettable event, which caused the loss of Sheikh Tusi's books, he had to leave Baghdad and he moved to the holy city of Al-Najaf.
The situation in Baghdad, you know, for the, say, for the century up to the time that Sheikh Tusi moves to Najaf, is quite a fluid one. It's, as I said, it's a period of the Buyid ascendancy. And the Buyids, broadly speaking, were Shia. Whether they were Zaydi or Ithnashidi is not that clear. But broadly speaking, they were definitely Shia. And, you know, they did significant things. For example, they established the public celebration of Ghadir. They established the public commemorations for Ashura. So these are two very significant things happening in the public space in Baghdad. Of course, Baghdad at that time is a very mixed city. You have different types of Sunnis. You have what's sometimes known as the traditionalist mob, who are very significant, who broadly speaking align with those who we would now call Hanbalis. You had people at court who engaged in rational theology, both different types of Sunnis, of course Shia. You have Zaydis, you have Ithnashiris, you have people from other faiths as well. Now, within this context, of course, there are differences and conflicts, but what the Buyids try to do is they try to minimize the conflict on the ground. But as their power begins to shift away, they couldn't always control everything that happened on the street. So you had a number of outbreaks in which basically the mob targeted people who they considered to be the leaders of those who were, broadly speaking, considered to be heretical, those who were not part of the faith. And they deliberately targeted the houses and the libraries and the spaces of those leaders. So that was very well known. It was, you see this, in this period you have also the development of a genre of literature which we now call heresiography, works which basically said, okay, which often started with the premise of this famous so-called hadith, you know, that the 73 sects and only one goes to heaven. So you had these works which said, okay, we, whoever we are the saved ones, and this is this is the list of all the people who are basically going to go to hell. Now you had the development of these texts, most of which were written from broadly a Sunni traditionalist perspective. So of course they had defined in those texts the Shia as the Rafida, as those who are going to go to hell, had already mentioned who their leaders were. So because of all of these factors, people knew who the Shia were, who the leaders were, and there was a sense in which there was a targeting of them. It's very different, I think, from many forms of modern sectarianism, in the sense that there wasn't an actual struggle on the street between different groups. It was very much, there was one group which was dominant on the street, who was willing to attack people who were seen as having different opinions, and particularly targeting their leaders. So it's much more a targeted attempt at going against particular types of Sunni rationalists, going against particular types of individuals who had a spiritual leaning which was different to them, and of course targeting those who were clearly defined as being Rafidis, basically, the Rawafid of the time, who of course were the Ithnashiri Shia.
We have to admit that the process of ijtihad, which never stopped within the Shia circle, continued, and every century we easily find some development, some advancement, some new ideas, new methodology. Although the basics or the fundamentals or the principles are the same, but continuous modernization or elaboration, or I mean talking about, so Sheikh Tusi started the process of ijtihad, which is unique. Then the continuation of that, of course, I mean, by many scholars after him. Let me tell you that for 100 years, no Shia scholar dared to issue a fatwa different to Sheikh Tusi's, until it was Ibn Idris al-Hilli, 100 years later, in his book As-Sara'ir, for the first time broke this sanction or this idea, said that, okay, Sheikh Tusi is a mujtahid, and if we use the same methodology of Shihad, and we can produce something. So it continued there later on. We see with Allama Hilli, with Shahid al-Awwal, Shahid al-Thani, and later on with Sheikh Murtadha al-Ansari, until now. So, but if we are talking about the role of Sheikh Tusi, of course, he is the founder. He is the one who laid the foundation of Ijtihad and Istinbat, how to deduce the law, the Sharia, from its sources. That's why he is always remembered as the founder of this process of Ijtihad.
The main difference in that early sort of period from, say, the 11th, arguably all the way up to the 13th century, is that a lot of teaching was very informal. It's only later where you get the establishment of, like, madrasas, you have spaces which are endowed to teach, you have money which is made available for students and so forth. That sort of process starts much later. In the early period, and this is true even before Sheikh Tusi, you have very much individual circles of learning, circles which are associated with a particular individual, and there's not much money involved. It could involve the patronage of a particular individual, but, you know, there's no systematic institution.
Sheikh Tusi's books on fiqh, entitled An-Nihaya, was formally used as a textbook in the theological schools and seminaries. He wrote another book entitled Al-Mabsut, which brought Islamic fiqh to a new stage and was accounted the most comprehensive one at its age. There are more books written by Sheikh Tusi. Other important titles are Al-Tadhib and Istibsar.
You know, nowadays we tend to look at the classical hadith corpus and say, well, you know, the Shia tradition has four books, right? And when you look at the four books, they're actually very different. So you've got the Kafi. Now, Al-Kafi is very different to Faqih, to Tahdhib, and to Istibsar. In fact, these three have much more in common. I mean, Al-Kafi in many ways is a different thing. You can kind of put that on the side, because Al-Kafi, I would argue, is predominantly theological. It's really about the fundamental doctrines around Tawheed, around Walaya, and so forth. Faqih, Tahdhib, and Istibsar are much more about rules. It's much more about establishing sort of a fiqhi framework, which is sort of essential for everyday life. Now, what Tusi tries to do in the period that he's in is that he's involved in this compilation, but the compilation is much more critical and analytically arranged than the earlier works. Because he's also trained as a theologian, because he's also trained in trying to make sense of chains of transmissions and so forth, what he really wants to do is he wants to organize the material in a more sophisticated and a more sort of rational arrangement. So the whole idea of tahdhib al-ahkam, you know, to to modify, to arrange in an order which is much more useful to use, to narrow down in many ways the corpus to things which he would consider to be more reliable and useful. And the same thing in Istibsar. Now, of course, when you look at these two texts, they are not as big, perhaps, as later collections of hadith, including ones which focus on legal rulings. I mean, one thinks, for example, of Wasail al-Shia and al-Wafi in the Safavid period. But they're still quite considerable collections of texts. I mean, I think if I remember correctly, the modern editions of Tahdhib and Istibsar go to about 14 volumes, standard ones. So there's still quite a significant corpus. Now, then what would happen is that once he'd kind of arranged and defined the tradition in this particular way, which of course involved rejecting lots of hadith which he didn't think had value, considering, you know, one of the biggest issues that early scholars had with hadith was how do you figure out, for example, which hadith are so-called hadith al-taqiyah, right? So, of course, there were a number of things which were reported and which, when you looked at it, it didn't seem to fit what was basic Shia practice. So, for example, in al-faqih, you have hadith which give you a form of the adhan which is not basically the Shia form of the adhan. So then the point then which is raised is, well, clearly these are hadith which come out of a context of taqiyya. So what Shaykh Tusi is trying to do in the Tahdhib and the Istibsar is to try and sort of clear out some of these sorts of rulings, because potentially they could confuse people. You know, if you have, say, a chapter on the adhan which has very different versions, it's potentially a problem. So there's this case of, you know, comparing texts and coming up with a corpus which is perhaps neater, more rational, more coherent in defining what the tradition is. So that's a development with which you see with respect to, in comparison to faqih of Sheikh Saduq.
I think there are three very important points in the life of Sheikh Tusi to be remembered. First, that when he moved to Najaf, he took a piece of land which was free there because it wasn't, populated area at that time when he moved around year 430, now 1,000 years ago. Yeah, it wasn't populated as such. So he chose a piece of land and made it his house, his office or center of education. His students migrated from Baghdad to Najaf, and that's why he lived there. But when he was going to die, he said that this house is not going to be inherited by anybody. This is going to changed and moved to be a mosque. And that mosque, Masjid al-Sheikh al-Tusi, is still there, only a few hundred, maybe 100 meters away from the shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And that mosque, as I remember, always has been the center of education, great ulama like Mirza Naini, before him Ahund, Muhammad Kadhim Khurasani. Later on, great ulama like Sayyid Muhsin al-Hakim and many others who used to teach there in that mosque. So it is the heritage or the something to always remember Sheikh Tusi there. This is one thing. The second point that the way he dealt with sectarian conflict in Baghdad, he did not allow anyone to put more fuel on the fire. He was always going to ask him to cooling them down and to spread the spirit of harmonious discussion with others. This is clear in his writings, in his books, in his way of dealing with others. That's why we do not consider him someone as narrow-minded person. So no, he was open to all discussions. And when he discusses the opinions, for example, of Abdul Bar Mu'tazili or others, in very fair, academic, unbiased way, so to teach us from those early days that how open to other opinions, how to deal with them in academic way, in very mutual respect without adding more conflict to the problem or, trying to cool everybody down to deal with the situation in a very nice way. The third point, in reality, that his work of Nihaya, three ulama in Baghdad, when they heard that Sheikh Tusi wrote a Nihaya, and we can say that Nihaya was the very first book of fatwa issued in the ordinary way, that people can learn and act upon. Before that, Sheikh Saduq, for example, used to issue his book of fatwa using or quoting parts of the hadith, not his own wording or his phrase. Whilst in An-Nihaya, we see that, no, it was written in a very ordinary way without quoting the hadith, all right? So three ulama from Baghdad, from his students or his colleagues, decided to go to Najaf. And they said that we don't know whether this type of work is good or not. Yeah, is it something to be approved of or not? So they decided to go to Najaf, stay three nights there, recite the Quran near the shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and write the questions they had to ask Imam Ali alayhi salam, that whether this book of An-Nihaya is authentic or not, can we act upon it or not, can we promote it or not. And they decided that whatever they saw in their dreams, of course it wasn't in the awakeness, but they was the when they were asleep, and whatever they received as answer from Imam Ali alayhi salam, they wrote it down. And they gathered together in the morning to compare what was the answer. And they did the last night when they stayed there after reciting the tahajjud and all other amal. They slept, and each one saw the Imam alayhi salam in his dream asking him about the validity or credibility of the book An-Nihaya, which has been translated into English. Then the morning when they were having their breakfast, each one wrote whatever he saw, and when they compared and matched, so exactly the same answer, Imam Ali alayhi salam said that this is approved by us and it is valid to act. So all the three rushed to the house of Sheikh Tusi to tell him about this, and before they started, they see that the same man who came to you in your dreams came to me and told me about that. This shows the sincerity of Sheikh Tusi and how honorable accreditation by the Imam. While it is not an accident, because three different people, but exactly the answer was exactly the same. And he, Imam alayhi salam, came to the dream of Sheikh Tusi to tell him about that. So we can remember Sheikh Tusi for all this.
I think he definitely saw himself as a significant leader, and he felt that he needed to provide leadership. But he thought that providing leadership primarily was about training people who were going to be the next generation of leaders, and also by contributing through what he wrote and what he compiled. That's very significant. So, you know, traditionally, the writing, the function of writing is central to scholarly leadership. In the modern period, we have a slightly different approach where we consider the sort of the lecture notes of students to be the corpus of the teacher, right? So in the modern period, from the 19th century in particular, you have this genre of what's known as taqrirat, right? So taqrirat are the lecture notes, basically, that students compile based on teaching. And then those are associated with the teacher. And in many cases, in the modern period, in the 19th and 20th century, particularly in the 20th century, most of the leading figures who are known as maraji' don't actually write very much, hardly any at all. That's very different from an early period. In the early period, it was very much what were people themselves writing, and then they were authorizing their students to teach those texts. And then, you know, it develops in that particular way. So it was really about what their own individual scholarly contribution was to the tradition. And in that sense, it's a much more significant kind of contribution than there is.
كأنه زعامة المذهب للشيخ الطوسي استمرت 24 سنة 12 سنة في بغداد بعد وفاة أستاذه الشريف المرتضى و12 سنة بالنجف الأشرف بعد أن انتقل من بغداد إلى النجف الأشرف أسس فيها في النجف الأشرف المدرسة العلمية الكبيرة كما ترون التي تسمى بالحوزة العلمية الحوزة العلمية التي رفدت العالم أجمع بمختلف العلماء والأدباء والمفكرين والمفسرين والرواة وما إلى ذلك ولا زال عطاؤها مستمر إلى هذه اللحظة كانت وفاة الشيخ الطوسي في عام القرن الخامس الهجري 460 هسه قيل أنه اختلاف في موعد وفاته منهم من قال أنه 458 منهم من قال 459 ومنهم من قال 460 بس الأصح لعله الوقت الأصح هو بعام 460 يعني في القرن الخامس الهجري اعتبار أنه قيل أنه بقى بعد أستاذه الشريف مرتضى 24 سنة 12 سنة في بغداد و12 سنة في النجف الأشرف
شيخ الطوسي's authority and impact was such that after his death for 80 years, no alim, scholar, gave any rulings, fatwas, which were different from Shaykh al-Tusi's. No scholar in the Shia or Sunni world covered such wide fields of study as Shaykh al-Tusi. He died in Najaf on the night of the 22nd of Muharram in the year 406 after Hijrah at the age of 75. He was buried in his home as per his advice, his will. His house was converted into a mosque, which later became a center for education in the Hausa. Till today, many scholars follow the footsteps of Shaykh al-Tusi. Until today, in his house, where he is buried, many classes take place.